of periods of good and poor performance and consciously try to increase the proportion of the time they are on target. Little by little, but not overnight, they might then show greater consistency. Let's turn now to the intake controls. Much information, both valuable and worthless, orbits around the minds of our kids in school. What are they supposed to do with it? How can they manage the daily data deluge? What needs to occur for a mind to choose the right information to process at the right time, and then to concentrate deeply enough to extract some meaningful ideas and absorb enough of it? How does your child manage to arrive at an active enough state of mind to get the most out of what he's focused on? And how is he able to remain focused long enough to learn something, but not so long that he becomes bogged down and can't switch over to the next relevant topic or activity? The answers to all these questions reside in part within the intake controls of attention, for it is their joint responsibility to prepare the mind for thinking, making the best use of available newly arrived or remembered facts, ideas, and experiences. 5 neurodevelopmental functions split the chores of intake control. The first is selection control. Jarring, reverberating buzzers that seemed nearly to break the sound barrier. Irrelevant and irreverent comments from your friends. Predictable cautions or threats from your teachers. And overstimulating bulletin boards blend together with far more cogent information during a typical day at school. Unconsciously, but with virtuous persistence, attention rapidly inspects all candidates for admission to the thinking brain, filters out and discards what it deems irrelevant, welcomes a chosen few stimuli into consciousness, and then invites the most timely and informative of these selections to penetrate deeply enough to be understood and/or remembered or else used right away. Selection control disposes of worthless stimuli, such as the quiet hum of a fluorescent bulb or the totally irrelevant memories that may be competing for attention. Selection control does not actually interpret or put to use what we hear or see. It just picks out the very best items, the most important and currently relevant data. Selection control that works well is especially valuable in view of the fact that a mind has very little capacity from moment to moment for brand new information. The entryway that leads to conscious awareness is narrow, space is limited, so selection control is obliged to be highly refined. To succeed, you need to focus on what can get you somewhere. A child falls behind in school when he can't seem to prioritize and concentrate on the most useful information rather than worthless trivia. Your daughter won't retain anything of value from that densely packed chapter on the Russian Revolution unless she can be selective and discriminate between what's important and what's not. There's no way she can remember all of it. Also, a distractible young scholar can't come close to absorbing all of the most critical information contained in an article while simultaneously attending to the whispers, the blue jeans, the very cool guys that encircle her during a study hall. Therefore, there is a legitimate job for a reliable gatekeeper, for a selection process, for a way of determining which data will get welcomed into consciousness and which will be turned away at the door by the security guards of the input control system. Some students have a hard time deciding on relative degrees of importance. Others focus on too many things at once. As Clark once lamented, "You know, my head is just like a TV set. But I have no remote control for it, so I get all the programs on my screen at the same time." I'm sure he does, and that makes for a rather noisy and cluttered mind. When Felicia, a struggling, frustrated high school student, reported to me that she was suffering her most intense struggles in biology and history, I strongly suspected that she suffered from problems assigning importance to things. Biology and history can overload and overtake you with mountainous heaps of information if you're not deciding what's truly salient and what isn't. Kids like Felicia with intake control problems have their work cut out for them, studying for tests, taking notes, summarizing information, highlighting as they read. All learning may cease, when they need to retain the high points. More often than not, they come pretty close to including everything in a summary, like a monk copying verses from the Bible, because they don't prioritize among different levels of detail. I recommended that Felicia get plenty of extra practice underlining, taking notes, and summarizing ideas. In other words, consciously judging the importance level of information. She had a tutor who helped her with this a few times by having Felicia read an article in the Wall Street Journal and then underlining the most important parts in the story. By the way, Felicia had a strong interest in business. It's always good practice to start strengthening a function in a subject area about which the child feels some passion. She had to defend why she underlined certain words, phrases, or sentences and not others. Before she did this, Felicia was totally unaware of the need to stop and think about what's most relevant while studying or reading. Practice gave her insight and made this step a part of her routine. To tighten selection control among his entire class, one teacher I work with, John Riley, gave students an article to read and asked them to summarize it in 100 words or less. After they submitted their summaries, he returned these and asked the students to write a 50-word summary of their summary. The following week, they were asked to write a 25-word summary of their 50-word summary. All the while, he emphasized the critical importance of determining relative degrees of importance in globs of information. A great academic lesson. Depth and detail control. Once information is selected for intake by our minds, how deeply will it be thought about? How far into our consciousness will it be permitted to penetrate? We are all too familiar with the ancient parent complaint, "It went in one ear and out the other, he just doesn't listen. Sometimes it's as if he isn't even there." Somehow, inflow led nonstop to outflow. That may mean that the absent-minded little kid was scanning the information superficially and not in enough depth to make a deep enough impression within his mind. Children like that may have trouble retaining new material in short-term memory. After all, what doesn't get in very far leaks out readily. Clark's teachers regularly complained, "We have to repeat things 3 times for him to hear them." When information enters one ear and flees like a bandit from the other, affected children like our Clark tend to miss out on many essential details. If you are only superficially attentive, chances are you'll get the general idea or big picture of the content someone is teaching you or what you're observing during a science demonstration, but specific details pass you right by. Clark could tell you a lot about a brewing Asian conflict that's been in the news, but he couldn't name any of the countries involved or their leaders. In fact, so many children I've seen who fail to take information in deeply enough appear exceptionally well-equipped to see the big picture. Maybe that's because they're not at all bogged down with the details. They view their universe through wide-angle lenses. Many become skillful at conceptualizing, generalizing, and extrapolating, but not nearly so capable when it comes to attending to details. Clark certainly was a big-picture kid. Recall that he had flagrant problems with fine details in mathematics, despite his good grasp of the concepts. He didn't make such fine-grained distinctions as the difference between the numbers 46 and 64. Unfortunately, such attention control contributes to accuracy, a mathematical virtue. Clark improved when I got his parents to help him go back over his work a second time, on a little detail treasure hunt, we called it. His parents gave him points for every detail mistake he could find in math and also in his writing. Incidentally, the exact opposite finding can also be a sign of attentional decontrol. That is, some students allow information to penetrate down into their minds too deeply. How does that happen? These are kids who work painfully slowly and seem so preoccupied with the details that they fail to see the big picture. Following one of my talks, a teacher told me about a little girl in her class who would tell you all the names and dates in a social studies chapter on the Civil War, but then she would lose track of the serious human rights issues that made up the overall theme or purpose of the chapter. Such students need help learning to speed up and stepping back enough to perceive the overall meaning of what they are pursuing, rather than getting hopelessly entangled in the details. There must be an optimal depth at which to plant and examine incoming information. Important data should be perused in reasonable depth, but not so deeply that it slows you down and prevents you from getting the big picture. Not so superficially that you only pick up the broad outlines or general ideas of everything. Depth and detail control finds you the right mix at the right time. However, extremes persist. Some people remain big picture folks for their entire lives. They abhor detail and indulge the broad view, while others thrive on detail, tend to it, and may be unlikely to be great generalizers, conceptualizers, and visionaries. The adult world, its corporations, institutions, and organizations, needs both kinds of minds, collaborating. We can all cite examples of adults who are terrific detail people, but are unlikely to generate very creative products, and those who are innovative, far-ranging thinkers who never want to be bothered with details. Two kinds of minds. Mind activity control. Is your child's mind active or is it passive? Does she keep connecting new ideas to what she already knows? Or does new information settle in her mind without ringing bells or causing any real excitement? Or could it be that her mind is too active, so she keeps daydreaming, free associating, taking thought trips? Just as soon as information is embossed in a child's thinking, it needs to send forth signals to various relevant brain sites. No sooner does an active mind take in information than it lets that new bit of knowledge ring bells, forming associations and linkages with pre-existing knowledge or experience. A teacher mentions the dictator of an oppressed country, and an active learner starts thinking about totalitarian government and also about the country in question. He almost automatically thinks about what he already knows or believes concerning these topics and compares that with the newly processed information. An active mind is a vital aspect of attention control and a core ingredient of strong learning. The opposite of a reasonably active mind is a mostly passive one, a common finding among some seemingly apathetic students with attention control problems. A teacher is describing a famous martyr while Tiffany sits in class suffering from a bad case of malignant boredom. Her mind can't or won't attach that martyr to any other martyrs or to the country or times he lived in or even to his similarities to people she has known personally. Nothing binds to anything else. In her academic world, new information rings no bells whatsoever. The stuff just kind of bobs around on the brain's surface, sending out no offshoots, soldering no connections, resonating nowhere and with nothing. As Tiffany once confessed, I'm bored to death in school in all my subjects, except, of course, lunch and recess and sometimes gym. I don't even know why we have to learn all that stuff. I'm never going to use any of it anyway. It's just a bunch of facts you have to remember. None of it fits with anything in my life. The curriculum isn't alluring if nothing resonates with anything else. Kids who are passive processors tend to reveal few or no academic interests, although it can be helpful to identify an area or topic that does kindle a little intellectual heat within their minds. Such an affinity may be exploited to coax them to rev up their thought processes in school. While it is instinctive to most, these kids have to practice asking themselves, what does this fit with? What does this change my mind about? What does this new stuff remind me of? Parents and teachers can encourage active processing by regularly asking learners to link new inputs with what they already know or have met up with in their lives. For example, now that you're learning about political parties in school, what do you think about the way your dad and I voted in the election last year? Would you have voted the same way? Or, it's great that you're learning all about fractions and decimals and percentages. Since you love reading about sports, let's see how this part of math helps you understand batting averages and other kinds of sports statistics better. Parents and teachers beware. There are some zealous student thinkers who repeatedly overactivate their minds. Virtually every entering parcel of information or contribution from memory rings too many bells, triggers a burst of loose association, and launches their minds into free flight. A teacher may mention something about a dog, and Clark is instantaneously reminded of his dog and how he and his friend Sal were at the beach with their dogs last summer. Beaches remind him of the ocean, and oceans are so cool because they have sharks in them. They have whales, too. Wouldn't it be fun someday to go way out in the sea and try to see some mammoth whales? That would really be awesome. And you know, you could also sail all the way to Africa and check out the elephants and rhinoceroses. That would be truly awesome. At any rate, Clark is on a safari while the rest of his class is discussing something else. Such frequent flyer patterns of thought are common among kids with attention control problems. Clark's vivid imaginative excursions needed to be scheduled for times other than the middle of math class. This is one thing I got his parents working on, giving Clark plenty of opportunities to engage in imaginative play and other creative exploits, and then reminding him to cut off his free flights at moments when he needs to be attentive. With most attention control problems, I make no effort to erase a trait entirely. You probably can't anyway. Instead, I try to help parents and teachers attempt to rechannel, or in this case, reschedule it. Span control. It has been common, perhaps even trite, to characterize many a child as having a short attention span. But I think the problem is more complicated, since kids who don't concentrate long enough on certain inputs may focus too long on others. Then there are the children who seem to alternate unpredictably between focusing too briefly and tuning in for too long, a phenomenon technically captured by the vivid term perseveration. They seldom appear to stick with the right stimuli for just the right amount of time. As part of their control over thinking, children need to sustain attention long enough without overdoing it, without focusing for so long on a toy soldier that they neglect other information or demands. Once they learn to regulate the span of their focus, it is possible for students to shift attention seamlessly. So 10-year-old Rupert can transition from finishing supper to doing homework without any stormy emotional upheaval or verbal combativeness. That's because he's effective at starting, stopping, and redirecting his span of attention as needed. The ability to divide a span of attention while sustaining it, to concentrate on more than one thing at a time for the right length of time, is yet another formidable challenge or threat to attention control. While at first glance keeping your attentional eye on several targets at once may seem foolhardy, there are frequent occasions during which divided concentration is mandatory. The best example is driving a car or riding a bicycle, while simultaneously concentrating on where you're going and how to get there, on the complex skills such as steering needed to operate the vehicle, and on traffic. Shouldn't astonish us, therefore, that adolescents and young adults who have trouble with their attention controls have been found to be especially susceptible to causing serious automobile accidents. It may be that such teenagers should not be allowed to listen to the radio and drive at the same time or talk on a cell phone. Also, it might not be a good idea for them to have a peer next to them, since the compulsion to show off while driving may be more than their attention controls can handle. The parents and driver education teachers of such students need to caution them on these specific hazards. Work with a timer or stopwatch can be helpful for kids who seldom focus for the right length of time. They need some warning about how long something will take, and then they should be informed when they are halfway there. They should be encouraged to take periodic mind breaks, times when they stop and lean back and think about something other than what they are currently working on. Then they can get back and resume their attention. Such mental rest periods can help enormously with adjusting the amount of time given to a specific focus. In fact, I think all kids need to know when to stop and give their minds a refreshing break. Teachers should allow for this when engaged in an extended lesson or lecture. Nan Murphy, a teacher from San Diego, does this regularly in her 8th grade math classes. She calls for a 2 to 3 minute brain recess at several strategic time points during her classes. As she puts it, the kids come back from a mind break ready to roll. It replenishes their thought processes. Satisfaction control. Your kid makes up his mind about what to think about by quickly deciding what will satisfy him. What sort of information intake and use seems to meet a current need. He is likely to concentrate on something if it is entertaining, if it seems useful, or if it will yield tangible benefits in the future. So he can focus readily on his favorite comic, the directions on how to operate his new DVD player, or some advice on how to make a heap of money. If all is well, he can even focus on some information inflow that might not be instantly rewarding, gratifying, or entertaining, but could have a big payoff later, such as a terrific report card. Unfortunately, quite a few children with attention control problems are accurately described as insatiable. That means they can only concentrate on stimuli that are exciting and immediately stimulating. It might be that a 7th grade social studies class studying the early years of the Holy Roman Empire just doesn't do it for them. They are unable to delay gratification, to consider the possibility, for example, that succeeding in social studies will reap benefits down the line. Instead, they need to cash in and seek pleasure right away because they are so intensely insatiable. These perpetually restless children become bored and fidgety in a classroom as they yearn and burn for a more stimulating, immediately satisfying experience. Some kids have a special kind of insatiability that targets material acquisitions. That is, they constantly lust for more and ever more possessions. Of course, all children want things, but insatiable kids take such material longings to an exasperating extreme. Brothers and sisters usually resent the child's completely self-centered materialistic passions. Parents need not despair, as the trait is not all bad. Material insatiability may evolve during adulthood into a virtue called ambition. Often having collections of rocks, seashells, sports cards, dolls, moths, or whatever helps these children. When their insatiability demands are getting out of control, they can be told to go and add to their rock collection. Insatiability for intense experience is a second type. When the local intensity level is set too low for them, they may see to it by turning up its volume, perhaps by becoming more provocative, appearing to be troublemakers as they stir things up to appease their gnawing restlessness. At worst, in adult life, this form of insatiability can, and sometimes does, contribute to substance abuse, alcoholism, marital instability, and a reluctance to settle into any consistent career pathway. On the other hand, experiential insatiability sometimes evolves into highly constructive risk-taking. Some children with experiential insatiability show signs of budding entrepreneurialism and ambition. Parents should kindle this drive by helping kids develop their own websites, subscription selling, or other enterprises. Also, these children need a constructive or at least harmless outlet for their insatiability. It may be rollerblades or horseback riding or a team sport that satisfies them, but it is important not to let them go overboard and dedicate their lives exclusively to the pursuit of immediate intense gratification. Time limits for such activities clearly are in order. Let's turn now to the output controls. Having control over your mind's output is as essential as controlling its intake. Parents can detect when a child's mind lacks control over output. As one mom observed, he just loses it, that's all, and then he does things without thinking them through. We have seen how with effective control over inflow, a child's mind can grapple efficiently with newly received information. Similarly, output control improves the quality of his products and actions. Of course, this productive output of a young mind is dependent on the control of inflow, since so often we base an output on incoming messages, for example, doing what your mom tells you to do, or tracking the arc of a fast-approaching football and then catching it. So the two forms of attention control are often intertwined. In taking control of output, a child also relies to some degree on the control of mental energy. After all, it takes energy in the form of mental effort to rev up his mind's turbines and get his assembly line to operate. In fact, when and if output is efficient, he can actually conserve a good bit of his mental energy. It takes considerable energy to practice your French horn, but if you do so efficiently, it's not as exhausting, time-consuming, and boring as it is when you waste a lot of time and don't concentrate on what you're doing. Let's look at five aspects of output control. previewing control, options control, pace control, quality control, and reinforcement control. Previewing control. Prior to deciding how to act at a party or settling on a topic for your term paper, it makes good sense to look ahead and think about the most likely results of what is about to be done, said, or created. When he does so, your child semi-automatically addresses the all-important "what if I" questions. What if I say this, what will people think of me? What if I act like this, will I get in trouble? What if I write a book report about To Kill a Mockingbird? What will that be like when it's finished? What if I solve this math problem? About what should the answer be? Kids need to make continual use of preview scopes secured to the front walls of their brains. These scopes allow them to look ahead, anticipate, plan, and make good predictions. Previewing is so pivotal to the learning process that it needs to be taught explicitly in school. Whenever possible, kids ought to be engaged in coming up with a blueprint of what something will look like when it's finished. They should submit work plans and be evaluated on them. Such plans should include a description of what the final product will be like, much as a landscape designer would prepare a sketch of a proposed garden. Sometimes students should be required to write the last paragraph of a report first, and then keep that paragraph up in front of them while writing the report. In other words, the final paragraph is their preview, the destination toward which they are navigating. In the middle of a story, children should be given opportunities to predict how it will end. The students I know who read especially well are constantly previewing, predicting what's coming next while they read. Options control. Emily Dickinson often is quoted for her line, "I dwell in possibilities." She's not the only one. We all do. In hiking through life, we come to endless branching trails, roads to be taken or not taken, things we could do, things we could say, things we might try, strategies worthy of consideration. From second to second, we have to make choices between available options. Ideally, at each point in time, we pick our best option while we inhibit or suppress less desirable possibilities. Some children often omit this output selection step. In fact, at times we all do. We impulsively neglect a review of options and leap on the first thing that comes to mind. On the other hand, when a child weighs decisions, she is in a position to inhibit or at least slow down initial responses, inhibiting all her potentially ill-advised gut reactions and dangerous knee-jerk responses. She takes the time to think through her alternatives and then make use of a venerable process we call good judgment or wise decision-making. One of his fellow school bus passengers once approached Clark at the bus stop and called him a decidedly unflattering four-letter word. Clark immediately thought of his first response to that provocation. Did he go for it? Or alternatively, did he ponder his options and select the best one? He went for it instantaneously and pushed the younger boy into a snowdrift, caving into his first and only response. Clark's mother told me that happens at least 2 or 3 times a day. If he would only think about it, he would realize there are other ways to react, other ways to save face. It's not just behavior that's at stake here. Parents and teachers have to remind kids like Clark to review their options before they tackle a challenging school assignment. A student who ponders options in decision-making can survey a math problem and ask himself, what's the best way to solve this one? One who never thinks in terms of options just goes ahead and does the problem. In so doing, he may or may not come up with the most effective or optimal problem-solving strategy, often doing the problem the wrong way. Throughout their education, kids should be taught about such decision-making based on the conscious sifting through of options. At home, whenever a child gets into trouble, parents should spend time reviewing with her what her other options might have been. In school, children should have to think about multiple alternative endings for stories they read and then pick the best one. They should consider events in history and talk through the decision-making options that world leaders faced at different critical points. Students should acquire the experience that there is more than one option for handling every situation. Pace control. I so often wish Clark would just slow down, lamented his teacher. He's always in such a hurry. I keep telling him to slow down and cool it. He does things too quickly, and he invariably messes up. When I can get him to slow down, on the other hand, he produces fantastic work. Pace control regulates the rate at which activities are conducted. A child should not do things too slowly, nor would we want her to be frantic and frenetic with her output. There is obviously an optimal speed range for anything that we do. Pacing can also be set at too slow a rate. I've seen some kids with output control problems who grind everything out too slowly. Some actually move around at a snail-like rate. Some clinicians refer to them as hypoactive, hyperactive kids. Their bodies move at a crawl, while their minds may flutter from one pursuit to the next. Interestingly, just about all the children I've known like this have been girls. I've heard other clinicians say the same things. Boys with attention deficits are more predisposed to race their motors, while affected girls idle in low gear. Pacing takes in synchronizing. A student faces numerous academic challenges in which multiple components have to operate in synchrony. Writing is the classic example. When a student writes, she or he has to synchronize letter formation or keyboarding, spelling, punctuation, grammar, capitalization, prior knowledge, and vocabulary. If a child has trouble conducting multiple functions at the same time, a parent might need to help her develop a plan for doing one thing at a time. These children can be helped by teaching them to do things in stages instead of all at once. They need well-thought-out work plans to facilitate this process. All children need help to do things in steps rather than all at once. The output controls I have discussed thus far, namely previewing, weighing options, and adjusting pace, all serve to slow you down so you are a more reflective person. If you add together weak previewing, plus the absence of options, that is doing the first thing that comes to mind, plus frenetic pacing, you come up with the well-known trait called impulsivity, the tendency that so sabotaged Clark's day-to-day behavior. In many respects, the output controls have as their mission getting kids to slow down, to stop, listen, think, and look before they leap. Quality control. We need to watch how we're doing something, and we should evaluate how well we did it right after we've done something. The process allows for regulation, for self-righting. Whether driving a car, solving a long division problem, or interacting with your friends, it's wise to sense how things are going. Are you on the right track? Should you modify your methods or strategies? You need to terminate this activity. Children with output control problems tend to be oblivious or insensitive to feedback. They may not notice when they're making fools of themselves. While explaining something in class, they may fail to realize that no one is following what they are trying to say. That's called weak communication monitoring. They are not making sense to others. Sometimes when these kids don't understand something they're reading or listening to, they also may not realize that they don't understand because they're not monitoring their comprehension. The well-worn phrase, "Well, I don't get it," is an indicator of excellent self-monitoring, super quality control over thinking. Throughout the curriculum, teachers and parents should be emphasizing self-evaluation, the practice of gauging how you're doing during and after an activity. Kids should be encouraged to grade their own papers. They should use checklists to survey an assignment they might need to improve upon. For example, their parents can help students make use of a writing checklist that might include review of whether they have begun each sentence with a capital letter, varied their sentence structure, made use of topic sentences, and so on. Whenever a student submits a test to a teacher, he or she should insert in the upper right-hand corner what grade he thinks he achieved. Kids should be rewarded with a few extra points if they are accurate at estimating their grade. The stress is always on knowing how you're doing or how you've done. The critical job of being self-critical. Reinforcement control. If something has worked well for your child in the past, it should be used over and over again. That's positive reinforcement. If, on the other hand, she behaved or performed an assignment in a way that led to failure or punishment, it would be best not to do it the same way again. When previous experience seems to have no impact whatsoever on today's thinking, the results can be frustrating. Parents can tear their hair out when a child somehow treats every circumstance in life as if it is unique and unconnected to any of life's earlier episodes. He or she rarely seems to learn much from experience, positive or negative. Such a child may be immune to the effects of criticism, punishment, or even praise. As one despairing mother complained, "I keep telling him things like, 'You had such a good way of doing that homework last week, and you got such good grades. How come you're not just using the same tricks with tonight's work?'" I encourage parents to work with children who have poor reinforcement control by helping them keep diaries of things that have happened to them so they can discuss the ways in which these events or incidents can or will affect future actions for them. One enlightened mother applied this technique especially diligently over several months. "This has worked quite well with my youngest son," she reported. "He actually makes bulleted lists of important news events of the day in his life before he goes to bed each night. We go over his lists every few days and talk about what he did right and what he could have done better to make events go his way. When he does poorly on a quiz in school, we try to figure out what went wrong and then discuss how he could prepare differently in the future. And he does most of the talking. I try to be a good listener and avoid preaching to him. He comes up with his own advice to himself. I think he enjoys it. My husband did this with him recently, and they may believe they were a football team viewing videotapes of last Sunday's game to come up with strategies for their next game. The idea always is to learn how to learn from the past." Although they're unlikely to refer to these functions by name, all parents are constantly observing and often commenting on their children's attention controls. The controls play such a leading role in the scripts of everyday life that they hog the spotlight much of the time. Not only that, but the attention controls have to operate differently to meet the needs of different ages. Mental energy control develops most rapidly during infancy. That may be the reason why babies who have trouble sleeping at night are prone to develop attention problems when they reach school age. They are never quite programmed early on for the optimal balance between sleep and wakefulness. During the earliest grades in school, you should expect to see fairly intact control over mental energy. Your kids should have achieved a nice balance between sleep and wakefulness. Their alertness should be dependable, as should their slumber. They need to be able to mobilize mental energy at important intervals during the school day, such as when they must adjust to the seemingly unreasonable constraint of occupying a chair for extended hours. As one 8-year-old reported to me, "The worst part of school is all that sitting. My brain starts to hurt when I have to sit and listen for a long time. I can stay in my seat, but sometimes I want to zoom off and run around the halls." By second grade, you can anticipate that mental effort is also becoming well controlled as kids learn to delay gratification and do some things they don't feel like doing but have to. The intake controls display their steepest improvement while students are in elementary school. For example, there's a wide difference in how well a sixth grader can filter out distractions in a classroom when compared to a first grader or kindergartner. The latter are much more likely to be pulled off course by noises in the corridor or the fidgeting of a child at the same table. In mid to late elementary school, control over information inflow is expected to burgeon. A sixth grader is much more efficient at concentrating for an extended period and then shifting smoothly to a new relevant subject. A younger child may fail to sustain his focus or have trouble adjusting rapidly to transitions of attention. He is also more apt to tune out halfway through a story, especially if the plot fails to generate sufficient excitement. Finally, the output controls ripen during and right after puberty. They come into their own as a key but too often neglected theme of adolescent development. Virtually all the functions I will be discussing in this program have to operate faster and faster as the child matures. However, as kids get older, output controls function slower and slower and slower. In other words, well-controlled output requires adolescent minds to work slowly, to be reflective rather than impulsive, to take their time and not do the first thing that comes to mind. This is ironic, of course, since our high schools force our kids to do everything as fast as possible. They have to write quickly, think fast, remember on the spot, sprint through timed tests, and meet tight deadlines. This frenzied pedagogical rhythm is totally contrary to what the students' brains are striving to become. I think we should reward adolescents for taking as much time as they need to do a good job. Most tests should be untimed, or else students should be allowed to do as much as they can do well, perhaps finishing the rest at another time. The output controls are doing what they can to decelerate thinking, decision-making, and output, to make kids thoughtful rather than impulsive. Secondary education, therefore, ought to incorporate as one of its principal objectives teaching kids how to work slowly. That's what their developing minds are trying to tell us. A parent should monitor the extent to which an adolescent is able to slow down his mind, preview, think in terms of alternatives, and make use of previous experience to guide current output. I know one mother, a high school art teacher who studied the attention controls, taught her daughter Joyce about them, and then made the controls a central theme whenever she assisted Joyce with her homework. As an example, when writing a report, Joyce first talked about what it would have in it when finished, previewing, then discussed her choices for topics to include or exclude, options, then worked out a timeline for completion of steps in writing the report, pacing. When finished, Joyce was asked to compare her report to her plan, quality, and along the way she listed facts and experiences she had in mind that could be added to the report, reinforcement, using prior knowledge. In this way, Joyce's mother was fostering her 15-year-old's current mind development. The approach was successful, so she was also using it with her art students to guide them through projects. All the attention controls are so basic in regulating what a child does and says that educators and parents need to have a clear understanding of how, when, and where they work. Schools and families should discuss and cultivate the 14 controls of attention, which can be applied and strengthened in the teaching of virtually all subjects. If parents are familiar with the attention controls and how they sometimes fail to work, we will have far fewer kids with misunderstood minds. Attention is as brittle as it is intricate. A child, therefore, can start to experience problems with attention control at any point. Many factors influence attention. If a student has trouble understanding in class, his attention is likely to deteriorate. If a child is anxious about something, the anxiety drains off attention. A variety of different physical ailments and mental conditions negatively affect the attention controls. Therefore, attention is a revealing bellwether. Surveillance of a child's attention controls is a critical way to monitor her overall well-being. Inattention is a distress signal, informing us that all is not well within that child or between her and her environment. We know he can do the work when he wants to. In fact, when he can overcome his laziness and his attitude problems, he will succeed. Until then, it's up to him. We can't help him unless and until he helps himself. This was a terse report from the algebra teacher of a patient of mine. It is so typical of the kind of misunderstanding that causes children with attention deficits to shoulder all the guilt and blame for the way they are. When I explained to this boy that he was not to blame for the problems he was having, that he was an innocent victim of his wiring, he became radiant. There was hope. I gave him some articles to read about the attention controls, and he came back to see me with a lengthy list of questions. He was determined to get in control of himself. And by the way, his mom at a PTA meeting urged the school to get some training in neurodevelopmental function for the teachers. A lack of attention control may masquerade as laziness, a negative attitude, or just plain bad behavior. Yet these are struggling and confused students who want very much to succeed, to please themselves, and win the respect of the adults in their lives. They need our sympathy and support at the same time that they need us to hold them accountable for working on their attention controls. When they sense that we're on their side and not accusing them of being bad or lazy, they often rise to the occasion and show steady improvement. Teachers, therefore, need to form strong alliances with these children rather than adversarial relationships. The same can be said for parents. Our memory system. Poor kid. He studies and studies and studies with hardly anything to show for it. A few nights ago, he was up well after midnight getting ready for an exam. He must have gone over the material 100 times. He was determined to ace the test. To make a long story short, he didn't. A couple of days after the test, his teacher posted the scores on the bulletin board where everyone could see them. And his was at the very bottom of his class. He felt bludgeoned, worthless. It broke my heart to see the expression on his face when he got home from soccer practice that afternoon. He is so motivated, yet so totally frustrated by school. It's all gnawing away at him. I'm so frightened. I just don't know what he's going to do to himself if he keeps on failing despite all that hard work and determination. He's such a wonderful kid, so kind, and so interesting in the way he thinks. I just don't know how long he can take all this disappointment and frustration with himself. That was an impassioned email I received from an understandably distressed mother of a 15-year-old I eventually evaluated. Our team discovered that this adolescent was up against some serious memory barriers. Memory is a complicated, multi-departmental operation that does its work at many diverse brain sites, a lot of which have not even been located by neuroscientists. Nothing is ever learned without tapping into some component of memory. A child may be able to understand the fact, process, or concept as it is being explained or demonstrated, but without memory, none of it can be retrieved and applied. Without the collaboration of the proper memory functions, learning fails. During your child's school years, the pressure on memory intensifies across the curriculum without any let-up. Plenty of students who are astute in many other ways just can't withstand the memory strains. So often I see a child with reduced memory capacity stigmatized as dumb or slow, when in reality he or she possesses fine intellectual faculties, but a flawed information filing system. As children ascend through their school years, they keep coming up against encounters with new memory demands. In the earliest grades, they have to remember which combinations of letters go to make which language sounds. Then they move on and have to recognize words on a page the instant they see them, their sight vocabulary. From there, they proceed to filing in their memory banks thousands of spelling words and math facts. At each grade level, a tide of new memory demands engulf a child. Some students have enough storage capacity to succeed with distinction at a particular point in time or even throughout school, while others endure disheartening mismatches between the efficiency of their various memory facilities and the highly specific demands of the curriculum. Our mind storage depots can be divided conveniently into short-term memory, active working memory, and long-term memory. By understanding something about these three major memory departments, as a parent, you can be alert for specific shortfalls that may at any point sabotage your child's learning. Let's start with short-term memory. Ira was a 7-year-old whose parents complained that he would never listen to them. His second grade teacher was equally as stymied as she recounted the frequent instances when Ira would look as if he was paying attention and then completely ignore her verbal directions. She did observe that if she slowed down or gave shorter instructions, it sometimes helped, but she felt that wasn't fair to the rest of the class. Both at home and in school, there were countless times when someone would go over and over a lesson, immediately after which Ira would act as if he'd been absent. Confusing the picture was the fact that Ira was not at all obstinate, but a very well-behaved boy with a sizable collection of strengths and mostly strong attention controls. He was an outstanding athlete, an intuitive mathematician, a master joke teller, a non-stop colorful speaker with an overgrown vocabulary, and a very popular kid. Everyone liked Ira, and with good reason. He was a real people person. But his parents and his phenomenal older sister Samantha were forever trying to help Ira learn. His dad once told me, "Getting this kid to learn something new feels like trying to break into a bank vault. His mind's just locked shut." But I'll tell you one thing about Ira. Once he knows something, he knows it forever. It's just getting him to pick it up in the first place. That's the killer. Recently, we have asked him to repeat important instructions to us right after we say them. We obviously don't do that all the time, but when we do, it helps. Ira's father was describing a classic case of a child with short-term memory dysfunction. Short-term memory is learning's front entrance. I tried to explain this to Ira. My explanation went something like this. Ira, when you first hear or see something, it goes inside your brain and it stays there for a few seconds while you decide real fast how you will use it. It might be that you'll do something with it. So if your mind says, "Ira, blow your nose," you can remember what it said just long enough to do it or to decide it doesn't need blowing. That place in your mind where things stop off is called short-term memory because it holds things for such a short time. Some kids have a short-term memory that leaks, so they may forget things they've just heard or seen. I think that happens with you sometimes. You might forget what somebody just said to you. Short-term memory also serves as one of our mind's relay stations. As chunks of data enter our minds, we can send them to long-term memory for later use, use them right away and then forget them, or make use of them and save them for future use. Or, of course, we can simply forget the information and do nothing with it. Such options have to be exercised with breakneck speed in less than 2 seconds. Unless, of course, you apply for an extension. You can extend the life of data in short-term memory in several ways. Whispered under your breath, form pictures in your mind's eye. If it's visual, you can put it into words, thereby lengthening the amount of time that short-term memory plays host to the new inputs. These strategies, known as rehearsal strategies, can be beneficial for students. I asked Ira's mother to teach him some of these tricks of the memory trade. They seem to help him significantly. Ira told me, "I especially like taking pictures with my mind camera. Like when my teacher's talking, I sometimes make a mental video of what she's talking about. And that helps me keep it all in my mind, you know, so it doesn't leak out. Then when I want to remember the stuff, I can go to rent the video from my brain and watch and listen to it." I told you Ira was a colorful talker. It's a good thing short-term memory is short. It needs to be short because there's a constant torrent of new data competing for limited mind space. Therefore, information has to enter and exit short-term memory swiftly. We always need to make room for ever-arriving new information. Most older children and adults can absorb and repeat about 7 numbers in short-term memory. A few can handle 8, but most early elementary school kids can only cope with 4 or 5. What does this imply for school children? For one thing, it means that just about everything a teacher says in the classroom is way too big to fit into short-term memory. As a result, almost every message entering short-term memory has to undergo a process called recoding. Recoding is a neurodevelopmental function that takes on the very crucial abbreviating or condensing role. Incoming data get collapsed into a tighter format so they can fit snugly within short-term memory. Recoding usually calls for paraphrasing, a method through which students shorten long statements pretty much automatically without even being aware they're doing it. If a teacher describes what you need to do for your homework tonight, there is no way you can remember verbatim what she has said. The input has to get recoded into a more manageable, tighter, compact chunk. So the abbreviating or recoding process becomes a critical part of short-term memory. A child may whisper to himself, or else just think in words that condense his teacher's most recent announcement or pronouncement. A student may prefer a more visual form of recoding. This has been called a visual scratch pad. He forms images in his mind of what the teacher is stating. short-term memory comfortably accommodates such imagery. Some kids with short-term memory dysfunctions have difficulty recoding. Processes that are entirely natural, nearly instinctive for some children, have to be taught explicitly to others. Remember, Ira's teacher found that if she shortened information for him, he was more likely to capture it. I like to urge parents to help kids practice recoding by having them summarize instructions or even whole experiences they have fielded during the day. Ira told his teacher he could remember things better if he squeezed them down into a tiny ball. Short-term memory function poses another obstacle. Ira and his classmates have to hold on to types of information that enter through specific sensory pathways and are arranged in different patterns. Sounds, smells, printed words, verbal utterances, and emotional experiences are among the varied media. There's information that comes into short-term memory all at once, like the features of someone's face, while other inputs are delivered to our minds in a particular order, like the digits in a telephone number. So short-term memory must be highly versatile in what it accepts for quick storage. And here's where some significant differences between students become all too apparent. Some of them show superior visual short-term memory, while others are great at retaining verbal communications, but not so good at capturing visual fragments. Some have problems grabbing any information inflow that's arranged in a particular sequence, which can jam their brain circuits when they need to follow directions. Short-term memory is beholden to the rate of incoming information. Some students can enter material in short-term memory, but somehow are unable to do so rapidly enough. They have a short-term memory rate limitation. Their short-term memory can only absorb information when it is presented at a slowish pace, at least significantly slower than that used every day by the teacher, the rate of input that's compatible for most other students. Ira's teacher made that discovery. She needed to slow down for him. His parents arrived at the same conclusion. "We've learned to slow down when we have something important to say to Ira," his father reported. "That way, he seems able to take it all in. When we talk at our usual pace, we run the risk of losing him. Recently, Ira has started to remind us, 'Slow down so I can remember.'" One further issue worth exploring is the intimate relationship between short-term memory and the attention controls. Needless to say, it's hard to remember something if you're not listening. Tuning out takes its toll on short-term memory. Likewise, a child who has trouble detecting what's important may continuously file the wrong information in short-term memory, and those with superficial attention may not imprint important details. Therefore, when a child isn't retaining in short-term memory, it is legitimate for a parent to wonder, is it attention or is it memory? Generally, if most of the other attention controls are intact, it is likely that the child's in one ear and out the other problems represent a weakness in short-term memory. Now let's explore active working memory. Amber was 10 when she was presented to me at a conference in her school. Her teacher adored this child, but was rightly concerned because she was hopelessly absent-minded and forgetful. Additionally, she was way behind in reading, writing, and mathematics. But Amber, well liked by the other kids, thought up strikingly original poems and knew more about more things than anyone else in her class. This forgetful girl had an incredible memory for trivia and for little details associated with specific activities or incidents in her life. Her long-term memory was a real showstopper. It invariably astounded her parents. When called on in class for a specific question, Amber was unsurpassed. Her recall was fast and accurate. Her responses were elegantly packaged with clarity in complete, often complex sentences and wrapped up in impressive vocabulary. Unfortunately, her writing was disorganized and difficult to follow. Amber herself confessed that she kept forgetting what she was going to say while she was writing. Most often, she would even stray off the topic or question because she couldn't think about the subject at the same time she was spelling, punctuating, and forming letters with a pen. As she once told her teacher, There's no room for all that stuff inside my head. Every time I try to write, I forget what I'm doing. If I think about one thing like spelling, then I forget all about something else like punctuation. Or else when I have to think hard to figure out what I'm going to write, my handwriting gets real messy. I just can't hold things together inside my mind when I write. Ammer was able to decode individual words during reading.